Launching the New Ship of State, Chapter 10. America's new ship of state did not spread its sails to the most favorable breezes. Within 12 troubled years, the American people had risen up and thrown overboard both the British yoke and the Articles of Confederation. A decade of law-breaking and constitution-smashing was not the best training for government-making. Americans had come to regard a central authority, replacing that of George III, as a necessary evil, something to be distrusted, watched, and curbed. Finances of the infant government were likewise precarious. The revenue had declined to a trickle, whereas the public debt, with interest heavily in arrears, was mountainous. Worthless paper money, both state and national, was as plentiful as metallic money was scarce. Nonetheless, the Americans were brashly trying to erect a republic on an immense scale, something that no other people had attempted and that traditional political theory deemed impossible. The eyes of the skeptical world were on the upstart, United States. Growing pains. When the Constitution was launched in 1789, the Republic was continuing to grow at an amazing rate. Population was doubling every 25 years, and the first official census of 1790 recorded almost 4 million people. Cities had blossomed proportionally. Philadelphia numbered 42,000, New York 33,000, Boston 18,000, Charleston 16,000, and Baltimore 13,000. America's population was still about 90% rural, despite the flourishing cities. All but 5% of the people lived east of the Appalachian Mountains. The trans-Appalachian overflow was concentrated chiefly in Kentucky, Tennessee, and Ohio, all of which were welcomed as states within 14 years. Vermont had preceded them, becoming the 14th state in 1791. Foreign visitors to America looked down their noses at the roughness and the crudity resulting from the axe and rifle pioneering life. People of the western waters in the stump-studded clearings of Kentucky, Tennessee, and Ohio were particularly restive and dubiously loyal. The mouth of the Mississippi, their life-giving outlay, lay in the hands of the unfriendly Spaniards. Slippery Spanish and British agents jingling gold moved freely among the settlers and held out seductive promises of independence. Many observers wondered whether the emerging United States would ever grow to maturity. Washington for president. General Washington, the esteemed war hero, was unanimously drafted as president by the Electoral College in 1789, the only presidential nominee ever to be honored by unanimity. His presence was imposing, 6 feet, 2 inches, 175 pounds, broad and sloping shoulders, strongly pointed chin and pockmarked from smallpox on nose and cheeks. Much preferring the quiet of Mount Vernon to the turmoil of politics, he was perhaps the only president who did not in some way angle for this exalted office. Balanced rather than brilliant, he commanded his followers by strength of character rather than by the arts of a politician. Washington's long journey from Mount Vernon to New York City, the temporary capital, was a triumphal procession. He was greeted by roaring cannons, pealing bells, flower-carpeted roads, and singing and shouting citizens. With appropriate ceremony, he solemnly and somewhat nervously took the oath of office in April 30, 1789, on a crowded balcony overlooking Wall Street, which some have regarded as a bad omen. Washington soon put his stamp on the new government, especially by establishing the cabinet. The Constitution does not mention a cabinet. It merely provides that the president, quote, may require written opinions of the heads of the executive branch departments. But this system proved so cumbersome and involved so much homework that cabinet meetings gradually evolved in the Washington administration. At first, only three full-fledged department heads served under the president: Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson, Secretary of Treasury Alexander Hamilton, and Secretary of War Henry Knox. The Bill of Rights. The new nation faced some unfinished business. Many anti-Federalists had sharply criticized the Constitution drafted at Philadelphia for its failure to provide guarantees of individual rights, such as freedom of religion and trial by jury. Many states had ratified the federal Constitution on the understanding that it would soon be amended to include such guarantees. Drawing up a Bill of Rights headed the list of imperatives facing the new government. Amendments to the Constitution could be proposed in either of two ways: by a new constitutional convention requested by two-thirds of the states, or by two-thirds votes of both houses of Congress. Fearing that a new convention might unravel the narrow Federalist victory in the ratification struggle, James Madison determined to draft the amendments himself. He then guided them through Congress, where his intellectual and political skills were quickly making him the leading figure. Adopted by the necessary number of states in 1791, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, popularly known as the Bill of Rights, safeguarded some of the most precious American principles. Among these are protections for freedom of religion, speech, and the press, the right to bear arms and to be tried by a jury, and the right to assemble and petition the government for redress of grievances. The Bill of Rights also prohibits cruel and unusual punishments and arbitrary government seizure of private property. To guard against the danger that enumerating such rights might lead to the conclusion that they were the only ones protected, Madison inserted the crucial Ninth Amendment. It declares that specifying certain rights, quote, shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. In a gesture of reassurance to the states' writers, he included the equally significant Tenth Amendment, which reserves all rights not explicitly delegated or prohibited by the federal constitution to the states, respectively, or to the people. By preserving a strong central government while specifying protections for minority and individual liberties, Madison's amendments partially swung the Federalist pendulum back into the anti-Federalist direction. The First Congress also nailed other newly sawed government planks into place. It created an effective federal courts under the Judiciary Act of 1789. The act organized the Supreme Court with the Chief Justice and five associates, as well as federal district and circuit courts, and established the Office of Attorney General. New Yorker John Jay, Madison's collaborator on the Federalist Papers, and one of the young Republic's most seasoned diplomats, became the first Chief Justice of the United States. Hamilton revives the corpse of public credit. The key figure in the new government was still smooth-faced Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton, a native of the British West Indies. Hamilton's genius was unquestioned, but critics claimed he loved his adopted country more than he loved his countrymen. Doubts about his character and his loyalty to the Republican experiment always swirled about his head. Hamilton regarded himself as a kind of prime minister in Washington's cabinet, and on occasion thrust his hands into the affairs of other departments, including that of his arch-rival, Thomas Jefferson, who served as Secretary of State. A financial wizard, Hamilton set out immediately to correct the economic vexation that had crippled the Articles of Confederation. His plan was to shape the fiscal policy of the administration in such a way as to favor the wealthier groups. They, in turn, would gratefully lend the government monetary and political support. The new federal regime would thrive, the property classes would fatten, and prosperity would trickle down to the masses. The youthful financier's first objective was to bolster the national credit. Without public confidence in the government, Hamilton could not secure the funds which was to float his risky schemes. He therefore boldly urged Congress to, quote, fund the entire national debt, quote, at par, and to assume completely the debts incurred by the states during the recent war. Funding at par meant that the federal government would pay off its debts at face value, plus accumulated interest, and then an enormous sum of more than $54 million. So many people believed the infant treasury incapable of meeting those obligations that government bonds had depreciated to 10 or 15 cents on the dollars. Yet speculators held fistfuls of them, and when Congress passed Hamilton's measure in 1790, they grabbed for more. Some of them galloped into rural areas ahead of the news, spying for a song the depreciated paper holdings of farmers, war veterans, and widows. Hamilton was willing, even eager, to have the new government shoulder additional obligations. While pushing for the funding scheme, he urged Congress to assume the debts of the states, totaling some $21.5 million. The secretary made a convincing case for assumption. The state debts could be regarded as a proper national obligation, for they had been incurred in the War for Independence. But foremost in Hamilton's thinking was the belief that assumption would chain the states more tightly to the federal chariot. Thus, the secretary's maneuver would shift the attachment of wealthier creditors from the states to the federal government. The support of the rich for the national administration was a crucial link in Hamilton's political strategy of strengthening the central government. States burdened with heavy debts, like Massachusetts, were delighted by Hamilton's proposal. States with small debts, like Virginia, were less charmed. The stage was set for some old-fashioned horse trading. Virginia did not want the state debts assumed, but it did want the forthcoming federal district, now the District of Columbia, to be located on the Potomac River. It would thus gain in commerce and prestige. Hamilton persuaded a reluctant Jefferson, who had recently come home from France, to line up enough votes in Congress for assumption of debts. In return, Virginia would have the federal district on the Potomac. The bargain was carried through in 1790. Customs duties and excise taxes. The new ship of state thus sailed dangerously overloaded. The national debt had swelled to $75 million, owing to Hamilton's insistence on honoring the outstanding federal and state obligations alike. Anyone less determined to establish such a healthy public credit could have sidestepped $13 million in back interest and could have avoided the state debts entirely. But Hamilton, father of the national debt, was not greatly worried. His objectives were as much political as economic. He believed that within limits, a national debt was a national blessing, a kind of union adhesive. The more creditors to whom the government owed money, the more people there would be with a personal stake in the success of his ambitious enterprise. His unique contribution was to make a debt, ordinarily a liability, an asset for vitalizing the financial system as well as the government itself. Where was the money to come from to pay the interest on this huge debt to run the government? Hamilton's first answer was customs duties, derived from a tariff. Tariff revenues, in turn, depended on a vigorous foreign trade, another crucial link in Hamilton's overall economic strategy for the new republic. The first tariff law, imposing a low tariff of about 8% on the value of dutiable goods, imports, was speedily passed by the first Congress in 1789, even before Hamilton was sworn in. Revenue was by far the main goal, but the measure was also designed to erect a low protective wall around infant industries, which bawled noisily for more shelter than they received. Hamilton had the vision to see that the Industrial Revolution would soon reach America, and he argued strongly in favor of more protection for the well-to-do manufacturing groups, another vital element in his economic program. But Congress was still dominated by agricultural and commercial interests, and it voted only two slight increases in the tariff during Washington's presidency. Hamilton, with characteristic vigor, sought additional internal revenue, and in 1791 secured from Congress an excise tax on a few domestic items, notably whiskey. The new levy of 7 cents a gallon was borne chiefly by the distillers who lived in the backcountry, where the wretched roads forced the farmer to reduce and liquefy bulky bushels of grain to horseback proportions. Whiskey flowed so freely on the frontier in the form of distilled liquor that it was often used for money. Hamilton battles Jefferson for the bank. As the capstone of his financial system, Hamilton proposed a Bank of the United States. An enthusiastic admirer of most things English, he took as his model of the Bank of England. Specifically, he proposed a powerful private institution of which the government would be the major stockholder and in which the federal treasury would deposit its surplus monies. The central government not only would have the convenient strongbox, but federal funds would stimulate business by remaining in circulation. The bank would also print urgently needed paper money and thus provide a sound and stable national currency, badly needed since the days when the continental dollar was, quote, not worth a continental. The proposed bank would indeed be useful, but was it constitutional? Jefferson, whose written opinion on question of Washington requested, argued vehemently against the bank. There was, he insisted, no specific authorization in the Constitution for such a financial octopus. He was convinced that all powers not specifically granted to the central government were reserved to the states, as provided in the about-to-be-ratified Bill of Rights, or Amendment 10. He therefore concluded that the states, not Congress, had the power to charter banks. Believing that the Constitution would be interpreted, quote, literally or strictly, Jefferson and his states' rights disciples zealously embraced the theory of strict construction. Hamilton also, at Washington's request, prepared a brilliantly reasoned reply to Jefferson's arguments. Hamilton, in general, believed that what the Constitution did not forbid, it permitted. Jefferson, in contrast, generally believed that what it did not permit, it forbade. Hamilton boldly invoked the clause of the Constitution that stipulates that Congress may pass any laws, quote, necessary and proper to carry out the powers vested in the various government agencies. The government was explicitly empowered to collect taxes and regulate trade. In carrying out these basic functions, Hamilton argued a national bank would not only be proper, but necessary. By inference or implication, that is, by virtue of implied powers, Congress would be fully justified in establishing a Bank of the United States. In short, Hamilton contended for a, quote, loose or broad interpretation of the Constitution. He and his Federalist followers thus evolved the theory of loose construction by invoking the elastic clause of the Constitution, a precedent for enormous federal powers. Hamilton's financial views prevailed. His eloquent and realistic arguments were accepted by Washington, who reluctantly signed the bank measure into law. This explosive issue had been debated with much heat in Congress, where the old northern north-south cleavage still lurked ominously. The most enthusiastic support for the bank naturally came from the commercial and financial centers of the North, whereas the strongest opposition arose from the agricultural South. The Bank of the United States, as created by Congress in 1791, was chartered for 26 years. Located in Philadelphia, it was to have a capital of $10 million, one-fifth of it owned by the federal government. Stock was thrown open to public sale. To the agreeable surprise of Hamilton, a milling crowd oversubscribed in less than 2 hours, pushing aside many would-be purchasers. Mutinous moonshiners in Pennsylvania. The Whiskey Rebellion, which flared up in southwestern Pennsylvania in 1794, sharply challenged the new national government. Hamilton's high excise tax bore harshly on these homespun pioneer folk. They regarded it not as a tax on frivolous luxury, but as a burden on an economic necessity and a medium of exchange. Even preachers of the gospel were paid in, quote, old Mahangalela rye. Rye and corn crops distilled in alcohol were more cheaply transported to eastern markets than bales of grain. Defiant distillers finally erected whiskey poles, similar to the Liberty poles of the anti-stamp tax days in 1765, and raised the cry, "Liberty and no excise." Boldly tarring and feathering revenue officers, they brought collections to a halt. President Washington, once a revolutionist, was alarmed by what he called these self-created societies. With the hearty encouragement of Hamilton, he summoned the militia of several states. Anxious moments followed the call, for there was much doubt as to whether the men in other states would muster to crush a rebellion in a sister state. Despite some opposition, an army of about 13,000 rallied to the colors, and two widely separated columns marched briskly forth in a gorgeous, leaf-tinted Indian summer until knee-deep mud slowed their progress. When the troops reached the hills of western Pennsylvania, they found no insurrection. The whiskey boys were overawed, dispersed, or captured. Washington, with an eye to healing old sores, pardoned the two small fry convicted culprits. The whiskey rebellion was minuscule. Some three rebels were killed, but its consequences were mighty. George Washington's government, now substantially strengthened, commanded a new respect. Yet the foes of the administration condemned its brutal display of force for having used a sledgehammer to crush a gnat. The emergence of political parties. Almost overnight, Hamilton's fiscal feats had established the government's sound credit rating. The Treasury could now borrow needed funds in the Netherlands on favorable terms. But Hamilton's financial success, funding, assumption, and the excise tax, the bank, the suppression of the Whiskey Rebellion, created some political liabilities. All these schemes encroached sharply upon states' rights. Many Americans, dubious about the new Constitution in the first place, might never have approved it if they had foreseen how the states were going to be overshadowed by the federal colossus. Now, out of resentment against Hamilton's revenue-raising and centralizing policies, an organized opposition began to build. What was once a personal feud between Hamilton and Jefferson developed into a full-blown and frequently bitter political rivalry. National political parties, in a modern sense, were unknown in America when George Washington took his inaugural oath. There had been Whigs and Tories, Federalists and Anti-Federalists, but these groups were factions rather than parties. They had sprung into existence over hotly contested special issues. They had faded away when their cause had triumphed or fizzled. The founders at Philadelphia had not envisioned the existence of permanent political parties. Organized opposition to the government, especially a democratic government based on popular consent, seemed tainted with disloyalty. Opposition to the government affronted the spirit of national unity that the glorious cause of the Revolution had inspired. The notion of a formal party apparatus was thus a novelty in the 1790s, and when Jefferson and Madison first organized their opposition to the Hamiltonian program, they confined their activities to Congress and did not anticipate creating a long-lived and popular party. But as their antagonism to Hamilton stiffened, and as the amazingly boisterous and widely read newspapers of the day spread their political message and Hamilton's among the people, the primitive semblances of political parties began to emerge. The two-party system has existed in the United States since that time. Ironically, in light of early suspicions about the very legitimacy of parties, their competition for power has actually proved to be among the indispensable ingredients of a sound democracy. The party out of power, the loyal opposition, traditionally plays the invaluable role of the balance wheel on the machinery of government, ensuring that politics never drifts too far out of kilter with the wishes of the people. The impact of the French Revolution. When Washington's first administration ended early in 1793, Hamilton's domestic policies had already stimulated the formation of two political camps, Jeffersonian Democratic Republicans and Hamiltonian Federalists. As Washington's second term began, foreign policy issues brought the difference between them to fever pitch. Only a few weeks after Washington's inauguration in 1789, the curtain had risen on the first act of the French Revolution. 26 years were to pass before the seething continent of Europe collapsed into a peace of exhaustion. Few non-American events have left a deeper scar on American political and social life. In a sense, the French Revolution was misnamed. It was a revolution that sent tremors throughout much of the civilized world. In its early stages, the upheaval was surprisingly peaceful, involving as it did a successful attempt to impose constitutional shackles on Louis XVI. The American people, loving liberty and deploring despotism, cheered. They were flattered to think that the outburst in France was but the second chapter of their own glorious revolution, as to some extent it was. Only a few ultra-conservative federalists, fearing change, reform, and leveling principles, were from the outset dubious or outspokenly hostile to the despicable mobocracy. The more ardent Jeffersonians were overjoyed. The French Revolution entered a more ominous phase in 1792, when France declared war on hostile Austria. Powerful ideals and powerful armies alike were on the march. Late in that year, the electrifying news reached America that French citizen armies had hurled back the invading foreigners and that France had proclaimed itself a republic. The Americans enthusiastically sang the Marseillaise and other rousing French revolutionary songs, and they renamed thoroughfares with democratic flair. King Street in New York, for example, became Liberty Street, and in Boston, Royal Exchange Alley became Equality Lane. But centuries of pent-up poison cannot be purged without baleful results. The guillotine was set up, the king was beheaded in 1793, the church was attacked, and the head-rolling reign of terror was begun. Back in America, God-fearing Federalist aristocrats nervously fingered their tender white necks and eyed the Jeffersonian masses apprehensively. Lukewarm Federalists' approval of the early revolution turned almost overnight to heated talk of blood-drinking cannibals. Sober-minded Jeffersonians regretted the bloodshed, but they felt, with Jefferson, that one could not expect to be carried from despotism to liberty in a featherbed, and that a few thousand aristocratic heads was a cheap price to pay for human freedom. Such approbation was short-sighted, for dire peril loomed ahead. The earlier battles of the French Revolution had not hurt America directly, but now Britain was sucked into the contagious conflict. The conflagration speedily spread to the New World, where it vividly affected the expanding young American republic. Thus was repeated the familiar story of every major European war, beginning with 1689, that involved a watery duel for control of the Atlantic Ocean. Washington's Neutrality Proclamation. Ominously, the Franco-American Alliance of 1778 was still on the books, but by its own terms it was to last forever. It bound the United States to help the French defending their West Indies against future foes, and the booming British fleets were certain to attack these strategic islands. Many Jeffersonian Democratic Republicans favored honoring the alliance. Aflame with the liberal ideals of the French Revolution, red-blooded Jeffersonians were eager to enter the conflict against Britain, the recent foe. At the side of France, the recent friend, America owed France its freedom, they argued, and now the time was to pay the debt of gratitude. But President George Washington, level-headed as usual, was not swayed by the clamor of the crowd. Backed by Hamilton, he believed that war had to be avoided at all costs. Washington was coolly playing for enormous stakes. The nation in 1793 was militarily weak, economically wobbly, and politically disunited. But solid foundations were being laid, and American cradles were continuing to bump a bumper crop of babies. Washington wisely reasoned that if America could avoid the broils of Europe for a generation or so, it would then be populous enough and powerful enough to assert its maritime rights with strength and success. Otherwise, it might invite catastrophe. The strategy of delay, of playing for time while the birthright fought America's battles, was a cardinal policy of the Founding Fathers. Hamilton and Jefferson, often poles apart on other issues, were in agreement here. Accordingly, Washington boldly issued his Neutrality Proclamation in 1793, shortly after the outbreak of war between Britain and France. This epical document not only proclaimed the government's official neutrality in the widening conflict, but sternly warned Americans to be impartial towards both armed camps. As America's first formal declaration of aloofness from old war quarrels, Washington's Neutrality Proclamation proved to be a major prop of the spreading isolationist tradition. It also proved to be enormously controversial. The pro-French Jeffersonians were enraged by the Neutrality Proclamation, especially by Washington's method of announcing it unilaterally without consulting Congress. The pro-British Federalists were heartened. Debate soon intensified. An impetuous 30-year-old representative of the French Republic, Citizen Edmond Genet, had landed at Charleston, South Carolina. With unrestrained zeal, he undertook to fit out privateers and otherwise take advantage of the existing Franco-American alliance. The giddy-headed envoy, all sail and no anchor, was soon swept away by his enthusiastic reception by the Jeffersonian Republicans. He foolishly claimed to believe that the Neutrality Proclamation did not reflect the true wishes of the American people, and he consequently embarked upon unneutral activity not authorized by the French alliance, including the recruitment of armies to invade Spanish Florida and Louisiana, as well as British Canada. Even Madison and Jefferson were soon disillusioned by his conduct. After he threatened to appeal over the head of old Washington, the sovereign voters, the president demanded Genet's withdrawal, and the Frenchman was replaced by a less impulsive emissary. Washington's neutrality proclamation clearly illustrates the truism that self-interest is the basic cement of alliances. In 1778, both France and America stood to gain. In 1793, only France. Technically, the Americans did not flout their obligation because France never officially called upon them to honor it. American neutrality, in fact, favored France. The French West Indies urgently needed Yankee foodstuffs. If the Americans had entered the war at France's side, the British fleets would have blockaded the American coast and cut off those essential supplies. America was thus much more useful to France as a reliable neutral provider than as a blockade partner in arms. Embroilments with Britain. President Washington's far-vision policy of neutrality was sorely tried by the British. For 10 years, they had been retaining the chain of northern frontier posts on U.S. soil, all in defiance of the peace treaty of 1783. The London government was reluctant to abandon the lucrative fur trade in the Great Lakes region and also hoped to build up an Indian buffer state to contain the ambitious Americans. British agents openly sold firearms and fire water to the Indians of the Miami Confederacy, an alliance of 8 Indian nations who terrorized Americans invading their lands. Little Turtle, war chief of the Miamis, gave notice that the Confederacy regarded the Ohio River as the United States' northwestern and their own southeastern border. In 1790 and 1791, Little Turtle's braves defeated armies led by Generals Hosiah Harmar and Arthur St. Clair, killing hundreds of soldiers and handing the United States what remains one of its worst defeats in the history of the frontier. But in 1794, when the new army under General Mad Anthony Wayne routed the Miamis at the Battle of Fallen Timbers, the British refused to shelter Indians fleeing from the battle. Abandoned when it counted by their red-coated friends, the Indians soon offered Wayne the peace pipe. In the Treaty of Greenville, signed in August 1795,